the headlines, a mass hunger strike in Israeli jails as hundreds of Palestinian prisoners protest against their detention conditions. Another achievement for Iran's armed forces, the country successfully test-launches several homemade air defense systems during the second day of military exercises. Plus, nearly 1,000 COVID deaths in a single day, Russia hits a grim new record since the start of the pandemic. Their top story for this half hour, Palestinians locked up in Israeli jails are fed up with punitive measures implemented by prison authorities. That is why hundreds of them have started a hunger strike to show their anger. Most of the 400 prisoners joining the action are members of the Islamic Jihad movement. They say the open-ended strike is in response to what they see as Israel's systematic abuse of prisoners. The regime has been imposing harsher restrictions on Palestinian inmates since last month. That's when six Palestinians escaped a top security Israeli jail. They were later recaptured, according to a rights group, Adamir. More than 4,600 Palestinians are being held in Israeli jails. Many of them are in custody under Israel's administrative detention policy that allows it to indefinitely keep the inmates without charge or trial. Palestinian writer and activist Jaffa Rimini joins us now from Perth. Mr. Rini, welcome to the program. First of all, give us your thoughts on the recent issue regarding the Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. Close to, I believe, 400 prisoners are joining in the action of an open-ended hunger strike. Unpack what is taking place right now for us.
This is not new. The Palestinians have had to use every weapon available to them to fight this aggressive occupier. And the last weapon for those prisoners is their stomachs. They declare a hunger strike to make the world maybe aware of how brutal the prison system in Israel is and how brutal the Shabak and the Mossad are when they treat the Palestinians. The Palestinians have no choice but to fight. Our leaders are defunct, they're no good, they're corrupt, and they're collaborators. Mr. Abbas prided himself in more than one occasion that his collaboration with Israel is sacred, and he and his security apparatus are the ones who handed the last two prisoners who were hiding in Jenin. This is my hometown. I was born in Jenin 78 years ago, and we will fight them to the last man standing.
Mr. Rimini, let's talk about the international response. Why isn't more being done for these Palestinian prisoners who've... it's well known that they're being held in draconian situations, in dire situations. Why is nothing being done? Why is not more attention being brought to the... to the status of Palestinian prisoners that are being held in Israeli jails?
Two reasons. Number one, and the major one, is this, the United States of America, who will not allow anybody to come anywhere near Israel or criticize Israel. The second is the fear, because Israel has a weapon that has been using since the 1950s, called anti-Semitism. If anybody dare to raise their heads above the parapet and say Israel is torturing the Palestinians, killing children, imprisoning women, stealing land, blah, 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 whatever, this is not allowed. They will be sneered and called anti-Semitic, and they will be hounded to the last inch of their lives. As I'm speaking now from Australia, there is an Australian journalist who was stationed in Jerusalem for 6 years, just wrote a book. The most horrendous assignment in journalism, i.e. being a journalist in Israel who will not be able to criticize Israel and asking his people, i.e. the Australians, why are we self-censoring when it comes to Israel and Palestine? The reason is very obvious. The Israeli lobbies around the globe are very powerful, and they are not bashful to use that power to smash anybody who will come against them. As I'm speaking to you, my friend, their foreign minister is now in Washington thanking the Americans for yet one more $1 billion of aid and pressing them for a fight against Iran. Why? Because Iran is trying to build a civilian nuclear power. Yet Israel, who has 300 plus nuclear heads, nobody talks about. But Iran is a taboo. You cannot do it. Why? Because Israel doesn't want it. And what Israel doesn't want, Israel gets.
Thanks a lot. Palestinian writer and activist Jeff Haramini joining us from Perth. Elsewhere, the Iranian army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps are holding a joint air defense drill for a second day. The exercises are being staged in Semnan, a central province of Iran. Several domestically made air defense systems have been successfully tested. The drills also feature homemade missiles, radars, reconnaissance, and electronic warfare, as well as communication systems. Troops are conducting tactical and defense operations using detection and combat systems against mock enemy aircraft. Iran says the drills aim to boost domestic air defense capability. Commander of Iran's air defense drills, General Badr Rahimzadeh, says the ongoing exercises carry one key message for the enemy, that Iran is fully prepared to defend its skies.
A complicated environment was designed, and based on our perception and understanding of the threats, we created a similar environment, and all these systems, including missiles, some radar systems, and the electronic warfare systems, data collection systems, they all managed to fulfill their duties and missions with 100% success. The message of the drills for our nation and our friendly and neighboring states is a message of peace, security, and friendship. We want to maintain the security of our skies, but the message for the enemies is that our armed forces are strong and have received technical training, and our armed forces enjoy homegrown systems, and we are fully prepared to defend our skies, and we will definitely give a crushing and decisive response to the enemies.
Iraq's Fatah Alliance is opposed to the preliminary vote results and says will not back down from protecting the ballots cast in Sunday's general elections. Take a listen to what the movement spokesman had to say about the early outcome of the vote.
We will not withdraw, we'll not stand back. We'll continue to defend your voices. This is for all our people, all our brothers and sisters who have run for the elections, the candidates, all those candidates that gave in objections and complaints from this election, first of all, in order to fight or defend their voices and votes of our supporters, but also the votes of all the Iraqis.
Asadi also complained about lack of transparency in the announcement of the results. Leader of the Fatah Alliance, Hadi Al-Ahmadi, earlier said he will in no way accept the results that are, in his words, fabricated. But the leader of the Sadr movement has advised against such objections, saying pressuring the Election Commission could trigger acts of terrorism in Iraq. Muqtada al-Sadr has called on everyone to be patient and make their objections heard through legal means. Based on initial results, Fatah has only won about a dozen seats, down from 48 before, but Sadr's bloc has expanded its grip with more than 70 seats. And correspondent in Baghdad, Wissam Bahrani, tells us about concerns that differences over the vote results could lead to violence across Iraq.
As these changes occur and revised in the coming days, we're seeing an increase in security presence across the country, but especially in the capital, Baghdad. And there are fears, you know, that as these disputes occur, that there could be some form of violence, which is the last thing Iraq wants to see. And all the parties are very aware and very conscious that this is something. This is a plot that if was designed pre-planned by enemy forces of Iraq to try and get these Shia blocs to fight among themselves.
Heavy fighting continues for control of a strategic region in Yemen. Army troops have reportedly liberated another 600 square kilometers from Saudi-backed forces in Ma'arib province. Army spokesman Yahya Sarei says Yemeni armed forces are now inching closer to the provincial capital. According to the official, 1,300 enemy forces have been killed and 11 spy drones downed during the latest operation. Sarei says the army will push forward to fully liberate areas under enemy control in Ma'arib. He says the Yemeni people remain steadfast in resisting aggression despite sanctions and blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition. Yemeni armed forces and their allied Ansarullah fighters have lately intensified their battle to drive out Saudi-backed forces from the strategic province. Political commentator Barry Grossman tells us Saudi Arabia must stop the military aggression against Yemen sooner than later, for the simple reason that it's well aware the conflict has no military solution.
The simple fact of the matter is that there is no military solution here. It's high time the Saudis accepted what they've long realized and stopped this belligerent war, which from the outset was supported by the United Nations and, of course, the United States, the United Kingdom, to some extent, the European Union, Israel, and others, not the least of which, of course, is Emirates. Sadly, in recent weeks, the mandate that had existed from the UN for a war crimes investigation come tribunal was voted to an end after a great deal of lobbying by the Saudis. So they're breathing a sigh of relief, and that can only serve as further encouragement for the Saudis to continue this belligerent war.
Well, this just in breaking news and continuation of the Israeli land grab policy and home demolitions in occupied Palestinian territories. Israeli forces have now destroyed a Palestinian house in Qalansua. We'll keep you posted on the details of that story. Elsewhere, though, bad news from Russia, where the number of daily COVID deaths has hit a new record for the second consecutive day. The country's coronavirus task force has reported nearly 990 new fatalities in the latest 24-hour period. Over 28,000 new infections have also been registered. The latest spike in Russia has been linked to the spread of the contagious Delta variant and a low vaccination drive. Ukraine has also recorded its second highest daily COVID death since the start of the pandemic. The 470 fatalities reported on Wednesday bring the country's total death toll to over 59,000. The Ukrainian Health Ministry says more than 16,000 people have also been infected in the past 24 hours. And Beijing is seeking to ease concerns about its military exercises near Taiwan. It says the drills are meant to counter foreign interference and deal with forces seeking to separate the island from mainland China.
The PLA's military drills are necessary, aiming to safeguard national sovereignty and territorial integrity, targeted at secessionist activities aiming at Taiwan independence and interference of external forces, with the purpose of fundamentally safeguarding the overall interests of the Chinese nation and the vital interests of compatriots on both sides of the straits.
China's Office for Taiwan Affairs said the purpose of the drills is to promote peace and stability. The current tensions, it added, stem from the island's collusion with foreign forces and separatist activities. Recently, China has flown a record number of military jets over Taiwan's airspace after Britain sent a warship through the Taiwan Strait. Also, Taipei's growing military reliance on Washington has upset Beijing. Still, Chinese and Taiwanese presidents offered a more conciliatory tone in their weekend speeches. China claims sovereignty over Taiwan. Political commentator Andrew K.P. Loing says China, Taiwan, and the U.S. are aware of the disastrous consequences of a military conflict, hence they refrain from getting into a war.
No doubt that Taiwan doesn't want to any kind of conflict because they know that it would mean disaster for the Taiwanese economy and the Taiwanese people. Nor does China want a war because there are so many problems on its hands. Neither does the United States. And because there is not 100% support for any American military adventurism so many thousand miles away from the homeland. But on the other hand, I think there is a bipartisan consensus to push back against China, even though, according to the latest think piece written by Jake Sullivan in Foreign Affairs, saying that the United States can both push back and cooperate with China. Now, it's easier said than done, because according to the think piece, it seems like the United States wants to have its cake and eat it at the same time.
Labor shortages have for some time been disrupting Britain's supply chain, and with Christmas holidays just around the corner, the government is now trying to assure people that the gifts they need will be in ample supply. Cargo ships have been diverted from UK's largest port to Felixstowe because there was no space to stack the containers. That happened due to a lack of trucks. Now Brits are worried that this could lead to a shortage of toys and gifts for the holiday season, but the government is trying to stop people from panic buying and asking everyone to shop as they normally do. COVID and Brexit conditions have led to congested ports. The government is now offering temporary visas for thousands of lorry drivers in the run-up to Christmas. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Eulogy recitals are a special and unique artistic phenomenon. The 3rd of February, 2021. Another aspect is the content of your eulogy, which is a combination of thinking, feelings and emotions, religious, historic and social information, and familiarity with the needs that the audience has. Notice that in today's performances, which were very good examples of eulogies, one's viewpoint about the affairs of the world and our own country was accompanied by religious and Islamic teachings. And this is an easy task for eulogists. It is second nature to them, and it shows the outstanding nature of this art form. The subject matter that the eulogists work on is the best or one of the best subject matters. This is because eulogists praise the best role models of the universe, praising Muhammad and his household, greetings and peace be upon them, and repeating their lessons and evoking their memory. With what you are doing, you constantly evoke their memory and do not let them be consigned to oblivion. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah. You draw people's sentiments to their lessons, their words, and their lifestyle, whether the occasion is about their birth or their martyrdom. Therefore, the subjects discussed by the eulogists are really outstanding subjects. Another important task that you carry out is creating a culture. In other words, reviving the memory and names of the Imams, peace and greetings be upon them, and the Holy Prophet, greetings be upon him and his household, is an act of creating a culture in society, and of promoting the ideas of those great personalities. This is a very good task. This is in fact expanding the Nabawi, Alawi and Fatimi lifestyle. You are promoting their lifestyle through your endeavor. Therefore, the issue of eulogists is a very important issue and an outstanding and valuable phenomenon. Fortunately, it is growing on a daily basis. In other words, this phenomenon is growing in our country each and every day.
Me hope, oh Allah, I want to thank you. wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It was an attack that killed dozens. The death toll could be around 150. A bombing at a Shia mosque in Afghanistan's northeastern city of Kunduz during the Friday prayers. It was the worst attack since the Taliban took over control in August. All victims of the attack were Hazara Shias. Their community has been targeted by repression and violence in Afghanistan for decades now. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the suicide attack. Daesh has repeatedly targeted the Shia community across Afghanistan in the past. Experts believe this recent attack targeting the Kunduz mosque served several purposes for Daesh. One of their goals could be attempts to undermine the Taliban's newly established government. The other could be to continue their long-running murderous campaign aimed at ethnically cleansing the minority Hazara Shia community, who constitute roughly 15-20% of the country's population. The tragic incident drew condemnations from Iranian officials. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, condemned the attack, calling on Afghan officials to punish the perpetrators. Ayatollah Khamenei urged Afghan authorities to take measures to prevent such terrorist acts. Also, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi voiced concerns about the persistence of terrorist attacks in neighboring Afghanistan. He stated that the growth of the Daesh terror group has been a U.S. job and that Washington has supported this group in Afghanistan. Also, in a Sunday phone call with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron, Raisi said the world must hold the United States to account for supporting terrorism fomented by Daesh Takfir group and other new forms of this ominous phenomenon. In addition, Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf condemned the attack, warning that the Afghan nation's enemies seek to stoke ethnic and religious discord in the country by using terrorists, who are backed by the United States. Also, Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, denounced the attack, saying Islamic nations and the international community have left the Afghan people alone. He called on Afghans to strengthen their national unity and solidarity and take steps to protect civilians from Daesh terrorists.
We know it's very clear that Daesh is supported by the U.S. and the Zionists. We've seen how they tried to disrupt Iraq and Syria and try to cause a major destabilization in these two countries. Luckily, there was strong resistance and unified resistance and a unified force to defeat Daesh and destroy them fully and eradicate them from the area.
In a message on Saturday, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on Afghanistan's authorities to punish the perpetrators behind the Friday terrorist attack targeting worshippers at a packed Shia mosque in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz. The bitter, tragic incident involving a blast at the mosque of Khan Abad district of Kunduz province, which resulted in the deaths of a large number of faithful worshippers, saddened us. Authorities in the neighboring and brotherly country of Afghanistan are seriously expected to punish the bloodthirsty perpetrators of this heinous crime and take necessary measures to prevent a recurrence of such tragedies. In fact, Daesh terrorists have claimed responsibility for several attacks in Afghanistan in recent weeks. This has put the Taliban under pressure because the newly formed rule vowed to provide safety for Afghans when it took power in August. Therefore, the Taliban has vowed to find and punish the perpetrators. They also have destroyed a cell belonging to Daesh terror group in the capital, Kabul, recently.
You know, we're hoping that the Taliban will make the right moves and treat this as a terrorist attack on its people. And this it obviously shows a sign of weakness for the Taliban if they do not prosecute these criminals and these terrorists, and it shows that there is an open door, an open hand to attack people inside Afghanistan, and that show a bad sign for Afghanistan's new administration. So if they really want to show strength, and they want to show unity, and they want to show that they are in control, they must prosecute these criminals, and also to stop further attacks like this that could cause sectarian problems as well in the whole region.
Former Afghan President Hamid Karzai had once said in an interview that the U.S. is colluding with Daesh in Afghanistan and allowing the Takfiris to flourish in the conflict-stricken country. In addition, many U.S. officials have confessed to Washington being responsible for Daesh's creation. Now that this unholy child of Washington's flawed policies in the Middle East is causing trouble, it's likely that we are going to see a major confrontation between Daesh and the Taliban in near future.
Britain grapples with a full-blown crisis. Labor shortages, truck drivers in particular, have disrupted supply chain activities and caused several problems. The significant lack of drivers meant deliveries of fuel and food were falling short. As a result, the country witnessed panic buying of fuel and some goods dwindled. These events triggered chaotic scenes across major cities, leading to long lines at gas stations and fistfights among drivers. Also, many factories and businesses are struggling with rising energy bills. They are on the verge of halting production and closing down unless the government immediately acts on spiraling natural gas prices. In fact, the crisis has already forced a wave of collapses among energy suppliers. This is while the government is planning to impose a levy on gas bills, which could push the prices further. The British government is now under fire for its handling of the crisis. So, being under intense pressure, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson blamed the trucking industry for Britain's supply chain mess. The industry called Johnson's claims wrong and pointed to the government's immigration policy and delays in testing and certifying new drivers as the main culprits. The government also claimed there is a global shortage of drivers. However, the European countries have not faced a similar problem. Britain faces a shortfall of 100,000 drivers. 20% of those are drivers who departed Britain after the country voted to leave the European Union. In addition, about 200,000 EU citizens left Britain during the coronavirus pandemic. So, how does the British government address the crisis? By introducing a short-term visa program. But by offering short-term visas to foreign truckers, the British government is admitting that exiting the EU was a decisive factor in the current crisis. In addition, many people are reluctant to uproot themselves and move to Britain for temporary and difficult work while they have better options in EU member state countries.
It's a crisis of the free market, a triumph of the free market. The government abandoned regulation, it abandoned public ownership, so it's private ownership. So we're depending for energy in Britain on people who make lots of profits out of energy shortages. So, if it's to someone's advantage to see gas and electricity prices shoot up, then they're going to go up. They're not going to say, oh, we're not going to take profits because it's bad for the economy. They're going to say, hey, send me more.
Households that spend a high proportion of their income on energy bills are considered to be in fuel poverty. Currently, 4 million people in Britain are already in fuel poverty, while up to 1.5 additional British households won't be able to afford to heat and power their homes. Last October, the government raised the energy price cap to control the sharply rising wholesale gas prices. The cap limits the impact of soaring energy prices on British households. The UK energy regulator said that the price cap must rise again next year if wholesale gas prices continue to go up. This could mean a typical customer paying between £400 and £600 more annually. That's while natural gas prices are at record highs as economies around the world begin to recover from the COVID crisis.
the government in Britain has recently cut back on the minimum payments for welfare and support for all sorts of people, from unemployed to underpaid to pensioners. So a lot of the apparatus that was very leaky, the very leaky safety net we already had in Britain has been torn up, and the government has decided that people, as a matter of conscious policy, they think that people only go to work if they're starving, so they're trying to starve people, and that includes freezing them. Freezing and starving will get them to work is what they think.
The price rises had already pushed 500,000 more households into fuel poverty. Unable to pay heating and energy costs, these low-income families are at a great risk. Many actually die every year because they can't afford to heat their homes. In fact, 8,500 people died in England and Wales last winter due to cold homes. All in all, the British government should stop blaming others and start cleaning up the mess it is responsible for.
In another sign of growing tensions in ties between Washington and Beijing, the United States Central Intelligence Agency announced the formation of a group that would focus exclusively on China. The CIA argued in a statement that the China Mission Center aims at addressing what it called global challenges to the U.S. competitiveness posed by the People's Republic of China. According to the U.S. spy agency, those issues include emerging technologies, economic security, climate change, and health.
The real threat that China poses that the United States is referring to is the ability to undermine the empire. And we see that right now, that there's definitely a global shift going on, which is starting to move from the West towards the East, of which China is the main power in this situation.
The announcement comes amid a wider prioritization by the administration of President Joe Biden on countering Beijing. In June, Biden announced a new task force at the Pentagon to assess and respond to Beijing's military challenge. The United States and China remain at odds over several issues, including the situation in Hong Kong, U.S. relations with Taiwan, trade, commerce, and the disputed South China Sea. U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly vowed to re-engage with the international community, marking a departure from his predecessor Donald Trump's foreign policy. In the case of China, however, it appears that he's following in the footsteps of Donald Trump's America First stance against Beijing. Top U.S. counterintelligence officials have reportedly warned that a concerning number of CIA informants are being captured and executed. According to the New York Times, the warning came in a top-secret memo the officials issued to all of the CIA stations and bases around the world last week. The memo suggests that the agency's Counterintelligence Mission Center looked at dozens of cases in the last several years involving foreign informants who had been killed, arrested, or most likely compromised. The cable itself was not necessarily unique, but as the Times notes, announcing the specific number of killings is rare, as the information is usually kept strictly under wraps by intelligence officials.
And this has been something that was significant enough that it was leaked into the mainstream media where it was reported on. It seems the United States sees this as possibly a potential crisis and something they need to reinforce with more bodies.
According to the Times, recruiting spies has always been highly risky. However, the cable warned that the CIA has not excelled in the area recently for reasons that include being too trusting of sources, underestimating foreign intelligence agencies, and moving too quickly to recruit informants while ignoring potential risks.
It's frankly acknowledged that everybody is spying on everybody else because everybody needs to know what their competitor is doing with regards to their stance towards them and what plans they have, etc. So in this regards, the United States is not doing anything new, nothing that it has ever done before. But the main bulwark of this, the main reason this is happening, is the U.S. is trying to expand its current intelligence network.
The report says that the uptick in the compromised informants highlights the growing prowess of other countries in employing innovations like biometric scans, facial recognition,
artificial intelligence, and hacking tools to track the movements of CIA officers in order to discover the sources. The memo suggested that the U.S. spy agency overestimated its capacities and underestimated its adversaries. The results show that countries targeted by U.S. espionage are becoming more capable of exposing agents than ever before.
U.S. social media giant has come under scathing attack by a former employee. The company has been accused of putting profit over everything else. Former Facebook employee Frances Hogan says that the company's sites and apps are harmful for children. She's also accused the social media platform of stoking divisions in society. 37-year-old Hogan was previously a product manager at the company. Now she's a whistleblower and has turned against Facebook. She made the accusation at a hearing in the Senate. Hogan accused Facebook of putting profit over safety and compared it to tobacco companies, arguing that a company with such frightening influence over so many people, over their deepest thoughts, feelings, and behavior, needs real oversight. She also said that if left alone, Facebook will continue to make choices that go against the common good.
If you look at the way that they filter content, if you look at the way that they censor certain topics that they'd rather not be seen, the way that they quote-unquote fact-check some of the things, the way that they delete accounts without discretion, the way that they censor people, and the way that they choose what content goes at the top of your newsfeed or shows up on your newsfeed at all through their algorithm, they really have a grip on what it is we are able to see on Facebook.
The context for the hearing were materials that she had leaked to the Wall Street Journal. According to the documents, Facebook's own studies suggest that Instagram and social media in general have a negative psychological effect on young girls. She also accused Facebook's CEO Zuckerberg of having too much power and bringing up the January 6th Capitol riot.
Facebook wants you to believe that the problems we're talking about are unsolvable. They want you to believe in false choices. They want you to believe that you must choose between a Facebook full of divisive and extreme content or losing one of the most important values our country was founded upon, free speech. That you must choose between public oversight of Facebook's choices and your personal privacy. That to be able to share fun photos of your kids with old friends, you must also be inundated with anger-driven virality. They want you to believe that this is just part of the deal.
Facebook has faced growing scrutiny and increasing calls for its regulation. Founder Mark Zuckerberg hit back, saying the latest accusations were at odds with the company's goals. In a letter to the staff, he said that many of the claims were illogical and pointed to Facebook's efforts to fight harmful content. The CEO argued that while Facebook took the initiative to create a massive research project to identify and solve certain problems, critics are merely weaponizing that work against the company to create a false narrative. Responding to Hogan's claims that Facebook's attempts to limit harmful content were constantly hampered by a shortage of staff, he said, "If we did not care about fighting harmful content, then why would we employ so many more people dedicated to this than any other company in our space, even ones larger than us?" Facebook is the world's most popular social media site. The company says it has 2.7 billion monthly active users.
So I think overall it's very detrimental to democracy because of the flow of information that is so tightly controlled through Facebook. And also think it shows, much like tobacco companies in the past or vape companies, that they've targeted children who are in very crucial developmental stages in their lives in order to get new customers, as noted in the testimony before the Senate.
Hundreds of millions of people also use the company's other products, including WhatsApp and Instagram, but it has been criticized on several fronts, from failing to protect users' privacy to not doing enough to halt the spread of disinformation.
Facebook, as I said, can truly decide what shows up in your newsfeed, what gets attention, what is put in the spotlight, and what is suppressed. And I think that's a big problem. It doesn't matter who you're friends with or who you like or the groups you're in, etc. They can filter stuff out through including certain ads. They can bury stuff in their algorithms. They can ban or censor or suspend accounts that may or may not go against the terms of service. Sometimes it's not so clear whether or not certain users go against terms of service, but find themselves banned or suspended anyway.
The accusations against the social media giant came amid a worldwide outage of the company's platforms. The social media services went down for almost 6 hours, impacting more than 3.5 billion users worldwide. The global outage and the revelations seriously harmed the media giant's status in the world as a reliable media platform.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Said Hakim was amongst the Maraja that was standing against the oppression in Iraq especially. Of course, his activities was not limited only to Iraq. He was worrying about Shia community all over the world.
When we study his lifestyle, we see he was really capable of teaching advanced level. Why? Because he was given this chance to revise the book of Mustamsak al-Urwat al-Wuthqa. By whom? By the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Muhsin al-Hakim.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers and jurists, especially the Shiite ones, all across the Nation of Islam. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Mahdavi, and welcome to your show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So in the 2021, September 3rd, we lost one of the greatest ulama of the Shiite world, a marja, a religious authority in the country Iraq. He was really an outstanding figure, one of the most outstanding Shiite maraja in the 14th century, according to the Hijra calendar. He was no one but Muhammad Sa'id al-Hakim. You know, just belonging to the Hakim family brings him a kind of fame And we know that Hakim family is among the greatest scholarly families in Iraq and the Shiite world. But today and in upcoming session of the program, inshallah, with your presence, we want to be more familiar with the scholarly life of Sayyid Muhammad Sa'id al-Hakim. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you, brother. Give us a little bit of his background and his early life.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. As you mentioned, late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Sayyid Hakim belongs to a noble family, which is known as Hakim family in Iraq. And as you mentioned, also belonging to such family is enough to know about yes. this figure. Sayyid Muhammad Sayyid Hakim, he is the son of the daughter of the grand Ayatollah Sayyid Muhsin Hakim,
right.
who is the author of the Mustamthakul Urwatul Wuthqa.
That's right.
Actually, who was the exclusive marja after the Ayatollah Brujerdi.
That's right.
So, Sayyid Muhammad Sayyid Hakim is one of the maraji.
Yes.
That maybe for us Iranian, those people who are, those Shia people who are living in Iran, he is not known. But for most of the people in Iraq, Pakistan, India, Azerbaijan, and other Shias, he's really well known.
That's right.
He is born in 1936, and then he continued his studies with his father and grandfather and Sayyid al-Khuy.
That's right.
Actually, the name of Ayatollah Hakim for Shias of Iraq is associated with the concept of Arba'in, oh. procession of Arba'in.
Okay.
He's really well known of the sacrifice that he did to revive. Mm-hmm. The procession of Arba'in or the walk of Arba'in
That's
is
right.
really popular and famous story circulating among most of the Iraqi people who are actually involved in this culture.
That's right.
Because of the Ba'ath regime during the time
yes.
of Saddam, they banned the procession of Arba'in.
Yes.
So no one was allowed to move
yes.
from Najaf to Karbala, which yes. was the custom of the ulama,
yes.
being practiced by most of the ulama during the history. For that certain period of time, we see that late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hakim is one of the maraji.
That's right.
That he did this procession, and following his action, he was imprisoned. For
That's
8
right.
years in the prisons of Saddam.
That's
so
right.
that is a kind of sacrifice, and some of the people right now, they are of this opinion that he could be considered as the people who had a key role in reviving procession of Arba'in during
right.
the last years.
Yes, that's all right. Yeah. So, I mean, Sayyid Muhammad Sayyid al-Hakim's, you know, imprisonment is because of his confrontation with the Ba'ath regime and Saddam regime. You know,
yeah, definitely. There are stories,
yes,
yes that
yes.
he was invited to a conference,
okay.
which was a kind of fake popular conference. Saddam
mm-hmm.
was about to receive some sort of fame and
yes.
popularity
yes.
through initiating this conference, and he
Saddam.
Didn't participate
yes.
in that conference. There are some other historical
yes.
accounts which indicates that this is also one of the reasons for which he was imprisoned.
Yeah, he refused to take part in that conference, and for 8 years he was
yes.
imprisoned, beside the other social activities we'll get to. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Mahdavi. Sheikh Ziyania, he was truly a practical alim,
yes.
you know, beside his scholarly life, which is really fruitful. He became a marja, an outstanding marja in the, you know, Hakim family. He got so many socio-political activities in Iraq, and we know that Saddam Hussein at that time was not kind person to the ulama. So many of the members of the Hakim families were imprisoned, and then martyred, were assassinated or killed by Saddam Hussein. And this shows the bravery of Sayyid Sayyid al-Hakim to oppose him in that country. Give us a background about this aspect of the life of Sayyid Hakim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As my dear brother mentioned, and you also proved the points, Sayyid Hakim was amongst the maraji that was standing against the oppression in Iraq especially. Of course, his activities was not limited only to Iraq. For example, when Shiites were killed by Sepah Sahabe in Pakistan,
yes.
Late Ayatollah Hakim was really upset and sent a message to the Prime Minister of that time of Pakistan, and the Prime Minister also responded to his letter and promised to follow the to prosecute and follow those people who were involved in the assassination of Shia people in Pakistan. It shows that late Ayatollah Hakim was not only active in Iraq.
That's right.
He was worrying about Shia, you know, community all over the world. And it is quoted that every moment, every time that people, I mean, officials used to visit him, one of his most worries was about the Shia around the world. And he used to say that Shia is an orphan. Mm-hmm. And for example, Christians, when they have some problems in their life, some, you know, governments, some officials, they are to follow their problem. But about Shia, this is not the case. Sunnis, they have their own organizations. But about Shia, he always used to say that Shia needs some organization to defend those ones who are oppressed all around the world in every different countries.
That's right.
Another important point of his activities was regarding the establishment of schools and libraries that he was involved in, the, you know, in these projects. For example, he has a very popular and, you know, big library in Najaf al-Ashraf, that this library is very modern, and it has different branches in Iraq, different in different cities. And this is one of his activities. Another side of his activities was establishment of schools all around Iraq. Yes. That he was, you know, following this way to promote the culture of the people of Iraq in a way so they be able to defend their, you know, rights in front of the oppressor government, especially Saddam and Hezbollah.
We know how much role the ulama and the maraja have in the country Iraq more than any other part of the world. I mean, in Iraq, especially under the oppression of Saddam and the Basque regime, and after that, you know, the taking of the country by the U.S. and all this turmoil that was happening over there in the region, this was the ulama, the circles of ulama, who could bring a kind of solidarity to the Shiite community over there, especially when the ISIS, you know, attacked Iraq. These were ulama, the Sayyid Sistani, Sayyid Hakim, and the other ones, the other outstanding maraja, Sheikh Ishaq Fayyaz, and the other ones, you know, over there in Iraq, could make a kind of unity among the people in confronting the ISIS and other foreign troops over there in the country Iraq. This is how a true marja, I think, in situations like this, can help the people, a practical marja like, say, Sayyid al-Hakim. Sheikh Mahtawi, Sayyid al-Hakim was also famous for some of his novel jurisprudential fatwas. Is it so? First of all, give us a background of what do we mean when we say a marja has a novel fatwa, or is this fatwa new or something like that? Some of the listeners might not be familiar with this concept.
Okay, that is a good question. Before we deal with this question, we have to say that this is one of the advantages and privilege of the Shia fiqh, that we believe the Shia fiqh. It is not like dogmatic things. We have principles from the Ahlul Bayt, but through the process of ijtihad that we learned from them and the companions of Imams, we believe in ijtihad, which is an advanced level of extracting ruling based on the principles we all learned from the Sharia law. So regarding this point, this is not the exception to say only we have such fatwas being issued through Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Sayyid al-Hakim. If we look at the history, we have different great ulama issued new fatwa